My name is Rolf Bergmann, and I will talk about manipulation and propaganda and how to recognize and deal with it. So you may ask, why is this important or what's the relevance? So why does it matter? Take the Iraq War. What happened? In February 2003, the US Secretary of State Colin Powell at the UN Security Council shows evidence that Saddam Hussein is in the possession of biological and chemical weapons of mass destruction. The evidence were drawings which were provided, as you see here, and are allegedly showing mobile production facilities for biological agents. The war started, and in September 2005, there was an ABC TV interview concerning the presentation to the UN, and Powell said it's a blot on his record. He said he felt terrible at being misinformed. So what happened here, whoever was misinformed or whoever lied, there was a start of a war based on manipulation and propaganda, and this was not the only propaganda that was going on. So manipulation and propaganda can have substantial effects on the lives of people. And my first question is, why is there manipulation in the world? Then I will give some definitions. What are we talking about? And then I will come to negotiation, manipulation and propaganda, and how to deal with manipulation and propaganda. So, the human heart and the responsibility of Christian leaders. In Mark, Jesus says, "For it is from within, out of a person's heart, that evil thoughts come." And then he numbers all these evil thoughts that come out the heart. And it's even worse if it comes to leaders, if it comes to people in a high position. Jesus says, "You know about the rulers of the nations. They hold power over their people. Don't be like that. Instead, anyone who wants to be important among you must be your servant." So Jesus reverses the order. And finally, in Romans, we read that that Paul writes, "Do not conform to the pattern of this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. Then you will be able to test and approve what God's will is, his good, pleasing, and perfect will." So, this talks about Christians, especially, I would say, those in prominent positions that have a responsibility to serve their society by discernment, and this discernment comes from a renewed mind. And so that's our responsibility to renew our mind, and with this renewed mind, discern what is going on and what is God's will. Now, first of all, I want to have a brief look on worldviews and ideologies and their consequences. Now, what is a worldview? A worldview or worldviews are collections of values, of concepts, of the explanation of the world, the society, the role of the individual, and the meaning of life. And some worldviews have also views on transcendence. This is a very rough categorization, but it gives you an idea. And I want to make the point, what is the difference between worldviews and ideologies? Ideologies are also worldviews, but they are ideas that are not based on evidence and good arguments. But ideology essentially serves to stabilize or change power relations. And this is a very important distinguishing. So, selfish or skewed worldviews, and especially ideologies, are dangerous. And manipulation and propaganda is to be expected. That's what I said before, what I quoted from Jesus in Mark and Matthew. And that's not all. Also, the resume of Rudolf Rummel, who is a political scientist, and he collected data about rulers and about governments in the 20th century, and he collected how many people these governments have killed of their own population or of other populations. And he comes to a very general statement that summarizes up the effort of his life. And he says, power kills, and absolute power kills absolutely, which means that power is dangerous, and the more power and the more unrestricted power a government or persons have, the more dangerous they are, not only for foreign populations, but also for their own populations. So this is very important to memorize. Power has to be restrained. And having said this, before I really start, I want to give some definitions so that we exactly know what we are talking about. So, what is an argument, what is evidence, and what is proof? Now, an argument or an argumentation is a conclusion that is supported by one or several premises through logical reasoning. A proof is an argument that makes a statement irrevocably true. Now, there is a good message and a bad message. There are proofs. The bad message is they are only existing in mathematics and in logic. So, if you remember your old school days, there's the Pythagorean theorem, that is the thing with the triangle, and this was true, it is true, and it will always be true. There's no doubt about that, and if you have the mental capability, you can look at the proof and you will see the proof is correct. So, Pythagoras found this theorem, and so he could show that it is correct. Now, this is not really applicable to ordinary life, because in mathematics we have a very well-defined structure and well-defined way of reasoning and very well-defined objects, and then you can draw this kind of conclusions. In ordinary life, this is not the case. So if you want to marry and you ask your fiancé or whatever, prove me your love, then you will probably be unmarried all of your life. So what are we doing in daily life? We are looking for evidence, and evidence is an argument that makes a statement plausible or even extremely plausible. Let's look at an example. Who is the murderer? The premises is the fingerprints of the gardener have been found on the knife that was used to kill Lord Baxter. Lord Baxter recently made the gardener his all heir. The gardener has no alibi. The conclusion is the gardener is the murderer. Now, is this a proof? No, this is not a proof. It's a basic element of science and daily life. However, even a very plausible argument is not a proof. Maybe the gardener was not the murderer. Maybe he was in his bed and was asleep and nobody watched him. So it's very difficult to find an argument that is so convincing that he goes to jail. Maybe there is more to it. But that is what we do in daily life, and we do not have anything better. We just have to look at reasonable arguments. So, what are we doing if we have a conflict? We go for negotiations. What is a negotiation? That is a dialogue between two or more parties to obtain certain goals. That's what we maybe do every day or every week or however. And this is a necessary part of life to resolve conflicts. At least it's better than taking a knife or whatever. It's better to argue, most for both sides. So, what is manipulation? Manipulation is a targeted and covert influence on the thinking, on the experience and behavior of individuals or of groups. And the aim of the influence should remain hidden. And this is the crucial point for manipulation. If you hide your real goals, then you manipulate people. If you lay your goals open, then it's negotiation. If you hide your goals, it's manipulation. So, manipulation is a dishonest form of social influence used at the expense of others. So we can say that argumentation serves to clarify good reasoning, while manipulation serves to cover up true intentions. That's a very substantial difference. What is propaganda and what is conspiracy? The last part of the definitions. Propaganda, the original meaning of propaganda is to spread or to propagate. The Catholic Church used that to say we propagate the gospel. So we tell the people about the gospel so that it spreads. Today, we understand propaganda as a conceptualized form of influence designed to build social consensus. And we will talk about that a little bit more in detail. So we do, or propaganda is done to unify a society to get a specific view on some task or problem or whatever it is. Conspiracy is, according to Wikipedia, it's interesting, Wikipedia has quite good definitions in this, a secret plan or agreement between people for an unlawful or harmful purpose, such as murder or treason, especially with a political motivation, keeping their agreement secret from the public or from other people affected by it. Of course, you have to keep it secret, otherwise it wouldn't work because you want to do harm to something or someone. And if you want to have an example of a conspiracy, read Daniel 6, Daniel in the Lion's Den. This is a marvelous example of a conspiracy. We don't have time to go into that, but if you have read that, then you know how a conspiracy works. So, having said that, we can go through our parts, and I start with the negotiation. So, there is a concept called the Harvard concept, and this is really a supreme way of negotiation. So I recommend you to get this book. It describes the Harvard concept and how to negotiate in a good way. And there are four steps to it. First, you have to separate the people and the problem. For example, if you have a scientist and a finance guy, a controller in a company, they will always have a problem. The researcher says, I have to spend $250,000 for a new machine. And the controller says, I don't have $250,000. So whether it doesn't matter who the researcher or the controller is, they will have a problem with each other. So you have to separate the people and the problem, or the position of the people and the problem. And the second step is you concentrate on the needs and not on the specific solution, because people come with something, they say, I need this, and the other one says, I need that. And then you go and concentrate and ask, what is your need? What do you really need? And then you develop several ideas, and that's very important in a fair negotiation. You develop as many ideas for the solution as you can get. So there may be five or six solutions to the problem which you haven't thought of. And if you have all these solutions on the table, then you insist that the final solution is picked that best satisfies the most important needs of both parties. Now, if you do that, you usually should get to a win-win result, and that's very important. Both parties have the most benefit out of it. You reach a factual agreement. You know why you have chosen this solution, and you have a resolved relationship, because typically you see people twice in life. So if the scientist and the controller meet the next time, they have a good relationship with each other. If they had not resulted in a win-win situation, they would have a bad relationship, which would make the next negotiation more difficult. And the idea behind that is honesty, fairness, and mutual respect, which are Christian values. The concept is not a particularly Christian concept, but the values behind it are Christian values. So it's very worthwhile to have a look at this concept and know how a good negotiation should work. Now, take an example. We have a lemon or an orange, and we have two children. Now, the two children come and say, I need that lemon or orange. And as a parent, what would you do? You take a knife and cut it in two halves. It's one solution. Is this the best solution? Maybe not. If you would have asked your children, why do you need it? What do you need it for? And one would say, I want to make an orange juice, and the other one says, I want to make a cake, and I need the aroma. A much better solution would be one gets the peel, the other one gets the fruit. So this is a much better solution that suits the needs of the kids much, much better than just cut it in half. But you have to go through this process, which is in this case pretty simple. But you can do it as well for nuclear arms, limiting talks or things like that, if you ever have to do nuclear arms limiting talks. Remember this example. So now we come to manipulation. Now we come to the central, one of the central parts. What are types of manipulation? There are many types of manipulation, but the two basic ones are logical manipulation and psychological manipulation. Logical manipulation works with conditional misconceptions, with logical frauds that the other party doesn't see. So if I say quit smoking and do more sports, then you will live longer. This is not a logically valid statement. Why? Because I could quit smoking and I could do more sports, and still I could be hit by a car tomorrow and be dead. So this is logically not valid. People use analogies. Just as water flows downward, capital always flows towards the highest rate of return. And many Christians like analogies, and they like them in the case that they support their own opinion. But analogies are dangerous, because that water flows downwards is just a natural law that comes from the gravity and so on. But that capital always flows towards the highest rate of return is not a natural law. It's a decision that people make. I could say invest in drug trafficking because it gives the highest rate of return. But I could also say, no, I don't, because this is immoral. So this is something different from a natural law. So this is not logic. There are many, many other examples, but I leave it with this too. The psychological manipulation. Often it's emotional appeals, like we are all in the same boat. It's a question, what does a person mean with that? What are the implications of that? And usually people say that usually not the owners of the boat say that, the others say that, to get an advantage of the property of someone else. Then there is black and white painting, very often found in politics. There is no alternative to saving the euro. Our former Chancellor Merkel has introduced the alternative lessness, the lack of alternatives into politics. She always said, there is no alternative, we have to do this and this. But this is mostly not true. If you think about it, you could maybe find other alternatives. And you could try to make better solutions, but if you don't want to have other solutions, then you say there is only one alternative, or there's no alternative. Or you attack the person. Of course, as a pastor, you have to say that God exists. So, which means I do not listen at all to your arguments because you are a pastor and your arguments are not valid, because you have to come to that conclusion. And the final example, the well poisoning. If you don't like an argument that often happens in the political area, then someone says, this argument comes from the right-wing corner. We don't have to listen to that. And so the argument is dismissed without talking about the argument. That's called well poisoning. Now, a common tactic is better a strong claim than a weak argument. So if you don't have good arguments, you just claim that something is this and this way. And you claim it again. You claim it again, 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 and again. And at some stage, people will believe it. So these are typical types of manipulation, which you find if you switch on the news or whatever, you will probably find one of these or another type of manipulation. Now, if someone comes, we are more on a personal level at the moment, if someone comes and says, I have this and this suggestion, then the first thing you should do is don't accept the burden of proof. If someone comes to you and argues for something, he has the burden of proof. You don't have the burden of proof that your position is right. The other one has the burden of proof that what he suggests is what one should do. So the burden lies with the one who argues against the status quo or introduces new unsecured claims or represents something that is contrary to general experience or asks for something very risky. So then he should justify himself why he or she wants it. And you, what you can do is ask precise questions. It's extremely important to ask the right questions. So what exactly do you suggest? This seems to be trivial, but if you think of it, in many cases, it's not really trivial what the other person means and what implications it has. So ask this question as long as you get a satisfying answer. What exactly do you suggest? What exactly are your consequences? What facts speak for it? What is the benefit? And if the other guy says, oh, there's a big benefit for you and you will earn a lot of money, and then you should ask, yeah, but what is your benefit? And if he says, oh, I don't have a benefit, you should be very suspicious. So this is a very simple scheme to ask the right questions. Asking the right question is a very important tool that one should use until one is satisfied with the answers. Now, we come from the personal regime into the societal manipulation regime. And the first rule, if you have something that is unpleasant to the public, hide it. You have hide it means don't talk about it on the newspaper, in the TV shows and whatever. Talk about anything else that is trivial, but don't talk about the real interesting stuff. Which does not mean that people cannot find it. If they know what they would be looking for, they could find it on the internet somewhere. But if no one knows what one has to look for, then people usually would not find it. If you can't hide it, then emotionalize, personalize, moralize, overstretch it, trivialize, confuse it. And if that doesn't help, then lie. That's the usual setting. So emotionalization is quite a strong concept. You just say, it's our moral obligation, we are cruel if we wouldn't, and so on and so on. And the next step is using ill-defined or misleading expressions. So if you hear abundant talk about justice, equality, or even our values, you have to be very careful. Because if someone talks about our values, you never know what exactly they mean and what exactly follows from our values. If someone talks about his or her interests, then we know what he is interested in, what he wants to do. But if someone talks about our values, you never really know what he wants, what he or she wants. There are some expressions which are not very well known. For example, reproductive rights. I don't know if you've heard of that and if you know what it is. In the context of a European Union document, reproductive right always burns down to abortion. So sometimes you have to be able to read the code, so you have to know what these buzzwords mean. But this is something one can learn. So if that doesn't help, then you have to use thought control, use agenda setting, and we'll talk about in a minute what that is. The next measures are not very nice either. You can try to isolate people. You can say this is a criminal or is mentally sick or whatever, so we don't have to listen to him. You can use violence or threat with violence by NGOs or by anarchistic organizations. And if that doesn't help, then you are in the position to do so, you can try to impose restrictive laws. For example, hate speech laws, because who wants hate speech? No one wants hate speech, but hate speech is a very ill-defined term. So it's very difficult to distinguish free speech and hate speech. So you can avoid things in public that you don't want to hear there. So there's a whole bunch of measures you can take to steer society in a way that you want to. Now, that leads us to propaganda. That's the next step here. And I don't know if you have ever heard of Edward Bernays. He is called the father of modern propaganda. He was born in Vienna and died in 1995 in the US. And he is the founder of modern propaganda. And later that was called public relation because it sounds much nicer than propaganda. So Bernays was a spin doctor and a public relations consultant, and he wrote a book called Propaganda. So, and one quote of this book is, "The conscious and intelligent manipulation of the organized habits and opinions of the masses is an important element in democratic society. Those who manipulate this unseen mechanism of society constitute an invisible government, which is the true ruling power of our country. We are governed, our minds are molded, our tastes are formed, our ideas suggested, largely by men we have never heard of." And this text does not come from some crude conspiracy theory people, but this is an original quote of Edward Bernays, who was a very successful manipulator and designer of propaganda. See what he does. His goal was engineering consent. So the fundamental to Bernays was Freud's view on man. Humans are irrational beings motivated by unconscious impulses and need cultural restraint and control. And mass psychology, according to Bernays, is as follows. If we understand the mechanism and motivation of groupthink, it will be possible to control and direct the masses without their knowledge according to our will. And the goal is engineering of consent in a mass society, in a democratic society, mass society. So, Bernays developed a strategic approach to public relations. And in the early 1920s, he was approached by the American tobacco industry, and they asked him to develop a strategy to increase their sales. And that was extremely successful, and later he developed campaigns for industry, for government, and for elections. If you want to see this at work, there is a very interesting YouTube video, The Century of the Self. It has several parts. And it describes the development of Bernays and how he worked and his successes. And it's a very illustrative video, 45 minutes or so, that is well worth looking at. Now, we have to restrain ourselves to one example, and that is the strategy of the American tobacco industry. The situation was public smoking was taboo for women at that time. That they just didn't smoke, that didn't fit. And the goal was make smoking acceptable and attractive for women. Now, if women would start to smoke, then the market for cigarettes would just double. Very simple. And the method was now to use cigarettes as a symbol of emancipation to break women's resistance for smoking. So a strategy consists of 3 points, the situation, the goal, and the method. This is a strategy in short words. What he did to realize the strategy was he was influencing the fashion industry and made Lucky Strike's shade of green at that time to the color of the season. And then he was creating publicity, which is, of course, very important. He hired some women's rights activists who lit cigarettes on the Fifth Avenue during the Easter Parade 29 in New York. And as it so happens, there were some newspaper reporters and took pictures. And there was a woman and a man smoking. Both of them were smoking. And there were other pictures like this. And then they proclaimed smoking of women as torches of freedom. So why should women not smoke? They are discriminated. We have to do something against this discrimination. And if women smoke, they show their emancipation. No one should think about such things like dollars. It is about our values. It's about emancipation. It's about equal rights and so on. So this was a very successful campaign. And as it was so successful, he did many other campaigns, which we don't have time to discuss here. Now, recognizing propaganda in our days. This is always the same. When I tell this example, then people smile a little bit. And I think some people may think, oh, these stupid guys in these times, we are much more intelligent, we are much more clever. However, we have propaganda in our day. So I will give you some examples. You may not agree with it because you believe the propaganda, or you may have another view. That's up to you. I just want to give you some hints where you can look at. Yeah. And of course, there are many more. We don't have the time to go through all these. So just for showing engineering consent at work. Recent or current topics which work with fear and lack of alternatives. There is a saying, follow the science. So I'm a scientist, I'm a physicist. I should like it, follow the science, that's fine. I'm a scientist, follow me. So, however, I think it's the most stupid slogan that has been invented, because there are two reasons, one practical and one fundamental reason. Science only gives you reliable results if the scientists are not depending on money or on prestige or anything like that. So if they can get their results free of any pressure, then you should expect them to get good results. But this has not been the case. This is something that is a little bit outdated, and it has unfortunately been seen that many scientists follow their own money or their own career. And there is a fundamental reason as well, because science can tell you how things behave, how things are, what is. So science can tell you, if I drop this this pointer, then it will take so and so much seconds to hit the ground. Or it can tell me, if I throw that at some person, it takes such and such seconds before it hits the person's forehead. But it cannot tell me whether I should throw the thing on the person. So science cannot tell us what we should do. What we should do is something that depends on our moral statutes, on our beliefs, on our ethics. And this is something totally different. So science has been abused, especially in the last years, to concentrate people on one reasonable solution and to exclude anything else. Currently, we have the last generation. These are the people that glue themselves on the street. What they do is, we are the last generation. After us, mankind will die out. And this is a lie. This will not happen. And they seed fear to enforce a specific action. Now, what is coming? There are some topics which are coming. And there is a big aspect of propaganda with them. And that's about safety and justice. So what I expect is, there are currently discussions concerning the pandemic treatment by the World Health Organization, and they try to get a worldwide control and override local governments. They will say, oh, this is important because we want to have everybody traveling safely. But in the end, it is about control, and very widespread control. I don't know if you heard about the central bank digital currency, also called the digital euro, but it is not a digital euro. It is something much more. It's something that every individual has his bank account at the central bank of Europe or wherever it is. And the consequence is control of everybody's finance in every aspect. And if you combine that with abolishing cash, what these people also want, then you have a total control about the finances of people. And if you take an individual CO2 footprint with it, no matter how you think about this topic, it doesn't matter, but an individual CO2 footprint, which is in discussion, would lead to a control of every aspect of human life. So under the pretense of safety and justice, there is a massive push towards control. And there are other examples, but I think you would agree that fear, control, and diminishing freedom is not what we want. And we do not want that as Christians. Also, other people who are not Christians do not want this as well. And it doesn't have an advantage for us. And there's a high price for propaganda, which is also important. The price is division. So people ask themselves, how can one trust a government that supports such developments? And we have a high division in society. There are people who are strongly against or strongly for one decision. And some realize propaganda, others don't realize propaganda. And so it does not help the peace within a society. It makes division and it makes mistrust. So the price for propaganda may be very high if you use propaganda. Okay, we come to the last part, our resources as Christians. I don't want you to leave this room depressed. So let us talk about some things we can do. There is a nice, a very good advice, not only to Christian philosophers, from Alvin Plantinga. Alvin Plantinga is one of the eminent Christian philosophers of our days. And he wrote quite some time ago, "The Christian philosopher or other people has the perfect right to the point of view and pre-philosophical assumptions he brings to the philosophical work. The fact that these are not widely shared outside the Christian community is interesting, but fundamentally irrelevant." So what he says is, we have the full right to argue with our presuppositions, with the presupposition that there is a God and there is morality and there are laws and there are values and so on and so on and so on, as others have the right to argue with the opposite position. And if we hide our convictions, we will not be successful. If we try to adopt the presuppositions of atheistic people, for example, we will not get to the conclusions that we think are right. So hiding one's own presuppositions is not a good idea. What happens actually is that self-censorship is increasing. There was a study mid of 2022 that found out that people have a problem with self-censorship. And one of the most frequent questions asked is, can I say this and that? Is it legal to say why something? So is it legal to talk about sex, marriage, gender, abortion, or whatever in certain circumstances? And sometimes then people say, especially Christians say, okay, I have to be considerate and I maybe should not raise my voice because it might hurt other people. And so there's a self-censorship. And this is not good. No one will thank you for self-censorship. You have to come up in a friendly and convincing way with your conviction. You have to state your convictions, otherwise they will not be heard. So we need to reclaim the freedom of thought and overcome self-censorship. Now, another thing is quite encouraging, and that were the conformity experiments of Solomon Asch. This is fairly old, in the 50s. I don't know if anybody knows that. There was Asch made the following experiments. There were test subjects, and they were asked to assess the length of lines. So the question was, you see three lines on the right side and one line on the left side. Which line on the right side has the same length as the line on the left side? You say, okay, this is a little bit stupid. I mean, it's obvious what the right answer is. Now, the trick was that there was only one real test person and there were several instructed test persons. So he had three or four or five test persons and he instructed these fake test persons all to give the wrong answer. And the last one was a real test person and he wanted to see what influence it has if all the others give the wrong answer. And the first result is very shocking. So if all these fake test persons give the wrong answer, then more than one third of the real test persons were also giving the wrong answer, although it was quite clear that this was the wrong answer. So there was a huge peer pressure on this person to give the wrong answer. And more than one third were notwithstanding this kind of pressure. This is a depressing result. However, there's still another result. In the next round, he said, okay, one of the fake test persons gives the correct answer. And so wrong answer, right answer, wrong answer, wrong answer. And then the real test person comes. And then the proportion of test persons who give an obviously wrong answer dropped to 5%. And this is really encouraging because if you raise your voice as an individual in an audience or in whatever situation, you can have an enormous impact on the situation. Because if you are somewhere and listening to something and you say, oh, this is somehow skewed, this is somehow wrong, then you think, oh, I'm the only one who thinks this way. And your neighbor or the person three seats further from you, he also thinks oh, this is somehow skewed, but I'm the only one who thinks this way. But if the first guy stands up or woman stands up and says, could there be a logical flaw in your argument? I don't understand how you come to your conclusion. Then it's for the others a signal, oh, there is something wrong. And then the next one stands up and asks this question, and the next one. And so you can, as a single, as an individual, you can change the whole audience. Not the speaker, but the audience. So, what we have to do is we have to overcome fear and self-censorship. And if you are in fear and self-censorship, no one will thank you for backing off. The Antifa will not say, oh, that's nice that you canceled your talk, or it's nice that you did not say this and this. The next time they will come and say, okay, but you have to get a step further and a step back. And you also do not have to say this and this and this and this. So it's a backward kind of movement that happens. If you are silent, then you will be silent the next time and the next time, and you have even less to say. Now, for many people, it will be a threat to have a discussion, an open discussion. So exercise your argumentation with one discussion partner, and then go from one partner to a small group and exercise your logic or your arguments and see what comes as a result. And then you can stand in front of larger audiences because you are confident, you have tested all the arguments against it. And then you gain confidence to speak in public, for example. If you speak in public, do it persuasively and not manipulatively. We do not want to make the same screwed mistakes than other people make, or we do not want to manipulate people, we want to persuade people, we want to have good arguments, we want to have a good standing. Then try to win the argument, the audience and not the presenter. So if you are a speaker, you can try to win the audience. If you are a listener, you can try to win the audience by making good questions. You will not convince the presenter, but you can maybe win the 100 other people sitting there, or at least give them questions to think about. And an important thing for me as a scientist is truth and logic are our friends. So don't be afraid. God has created truth, or God is the guarantee for truth, and God has created logic. And so these two are our friends, and we should use our friends to get good results. So with that, I come to the conclusions. I started at the beginning with saying that manipulation, propaganda, and ideologies are dangerous. The more power someone has, the more dangerous he will get. So power kills, and absolute power kills absolutely. Then I quoted Matthew 20, you know about the rulers of the nations, they hold power over their people, don't be like that. Instead, anyone who wants to be important among you must be your servant. So, the abuse of power and manipulation and propaganda is to be expected. Just assume that there is manipulation and propaganda. It has been, it is, and it will be. Unless we are in heaven, there is no manipulation and no propaganda anymore. Don't lament over it. Don't claim, don't say, oh, it's all terrible, but prepare for it. So learn the mechanisms to be able to work with them. And develop resilience and look for allies. So we have a certain situation. And there is no way to get around that. We have to find personal settings and friendships and allies who support us and whom we can support to cope with this kind of situation. And finally, take the word of God serious. Some people read the Bible as sort of a children's book, but there are stories about treason, about kings, about murder, about manipulation, about wars, about kingdoms who come and go and why they come and go. So we have all these stories in the Bible. We can learn quite a lot from them. But take it serious and not just as funny stories or so. So at the end, some recommendations, getting to yes, negotiating agreements without giving in. That's the Harvard concept. It's a small little booklet. I would like to recommend that to you. If you want to dive a little bit deeper in the presuppositions of a democratic or of an open society and what is beneficial and what is not beneficial, I can recommend Karl Popper to you. He has written a two-volume book, The Open Society and Its Enemies, but it's 250 pages. So it's, it's a question whether you want to take up this time. Also, Francis Schaeffer has, in a not very well-known book, as far as I know, written a Christian manifesto, and that was already in the 18th. And I was wondering, he was quite up to date. You can read that at some occasions as if it were today. So the situation is not unique. The pressure is increasing. The manipulation is increasing. But he shows and he discusses some way Christians can work with it. If you can read German, I would recommend my book, The Free Society and Its Enemies. It's a little bit resembling the work of Karl Popper and also of Francis Schaeffer. And I'll describe the developments that lead to the situation that we have today. So I hope that has given you some valuable input, and I thank you very much for your attention.